Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and this is your news update as we head towards the end of January 2026. In putting this news update together, I found it really interesting that some of the topics I'm touching on today are pretty new in terms of the UFO field. Some interesting updates from familiar names and some new emerging updates from less familiar names too. And we'll get to those as we go along. During the podcast, or towards the end, I'll announce some of the guests coming on the show too for the month of February. And there are some massive names scheduled, so do not miss out on that one, folks. So first up, I want to flag an interview that's been doing the rounds over the last couple of days and gaining some traction online. Because there's a few points people in there I think will find genuinely interesting. And of course, as always, I encourage you, any interview I discuss, please go and check it out on your own. Even if you're sceptical about the topic, the aspect of the conversation, this is one I think you're really going to want to check out. James Fowler, who you may know from Skywatcher, who left Skywatcher back in August 2025. He was the guy who basically had the dog whistle technology that he took and moved on with a job in a private contractor, I believe, as part of the US government, something like that. It gets a little murky. But James Fowler left Skywatcher, all seemingly on good terms. He was on the Emergent podcast with Reed Summers. Reed Summers, you'll remember from this podcast a couple of times. Many of you will watch or listen to Reed over on his own channel. But we'll get to the Tracking and Detection Summit that's due to come up in the next week or so. And I've got an offer for you folks on the podcast who may want to attend that virtually online too. However, James Fowler, speaking on Emergent and drawing on work linked to Skywatcher, described multiple incidents where objects weren't seen at the time at all. People were actively watching the sky, looking out for drones and seeing nothing. It was only later, going back through radar data and imagery, that they realised objects had been directly over their head, and in some cases near commercial aircraft, you know, your normal jets flying passenger routes. The claim isn't from James, and this is interesting, that these things are invisible. It's that they're hard to detect unless sensors are configured in a very specific, non-standard way. In other words, standard systems that they were using just weren't doing the job. One of the more interesting points is repeatability. That's a big one for those of us in the UFO community, I think. Fowler suggesting that when certain electromagnetic signals were used, activity followed. When they weren't used, nothing happened. So over time, the response got quicker, shifting from days to hours. That's not proof of intelligence per se, but it does suggest that it's not random noise either. James talked about different objects behaving in different ways, some moving in tight formations, others able to evade helicopters simply by climbing beyond their original operational ceiling. In one case, there are claims that when an antenna was pointed at an object, multiple systems shut down at once. Laptops, radars, cameras, bang, immediately off. Sounds very Skinwalker Ranchy, doesn't it, as well? And not just, I think Skinwalker Ranch, to sidebar, gets a lot of that. Oh, it's for dramatic purposes, it's for TV, but we hear of this happening all over, so it's nice to hear something similar happening, I suppose, in a different setting. Now, all of this, of course, we have to treat carefully. These are claims. They're not independently verified conclusions at this point. But taken together, they're pointing to me a bigger issue. Not necessarily what these objects even are. when it comes to the scientific aspect of this, we're not there yet. But whether our detection systems are even fit for purpose, are we being fair when we judge Skywatcher, for example, on not giving us the data they have yet? It's not as easy as getting a sensor or camera and point and shoot, of course, and trying to film something. Setting aside Skywatcher's early claims, where they did make some grand claims early on. We know that, folks. But for me, maybe it's more difficult than even we're imagining for them to do this. It's just not simple. I keep coming back to a communication analogy. If you send me a letter, it takes days to arrive and days for you to get a response back. If you email me, I'll probably see it quicker whenever I check my inbox and get a chance to respond. But if you phone me, I'm going to answer straight away. And maybe the part of the problem here is we don't understand yet which method we're using or that we're supposed to use. Are we writing to these things? Are we emailing them? Or are we actually calling them? And I think that's a good point to mention that upcoming UAP Tracking and Detection Summit. If you go to uapsummit.org, the link is in the description. It takes place on the 7th and 8th of February. Focus specifically on sensors, data, detection gaps, and how we even begin to study this whole phenomenon properly and scientifically. If you're interested, listeners, you can get 30% off your tickets. Go to the checkout, use code THATUFOPODCAST30. I'll put the details in the show notes. And listen, I've not asked for anything for this. This is literally just you get a discount off of the tickets, folks. Eric Burleson, Gary Nolan, James Fowler, Beatrice Villarreal, and a load more folks with very interesting backgrounds, including NASA, for example, that you may not have heard of, are attending and speaking as part of this conference. I'll be checking out and reporting back on all the highlights, but one of those I feel you'll get a lot from. If you've got the money and you can afford to jump on there, you get 30% off using that code. Again, it's all in the description, folks, so worth checking out. Over at the Black Vault, a couple of items worth reporting on from John Greenwald. For those unfamiliar, John Greenwald and his work, he's an expert at FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests. In the US, he sends off what must be thousands of FOIA requests every year on a variety of topics, including, of course, UFOs. And in the last couple of days, he reported on a recent FOIA request that was responded to. He issued it to the Department of War. So I'll just quote you here. The Pentagon has refused to even search for emails mentioning Immaculate Constellation, name of the alleged secret US military intelligence gathering program brought forward by Matthew Brown a couple of years ago now. Immaculate Constellation surfaced publicly after documents linked to the program, you'll remember, were provided to Congress by Michael Schellenberger. Matthew Brown then came forward as the author of those documents some months later through Weaponize with Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp, claimed the initiative related to the collection and analysis of UAP data across multiple classified channels. John Greenwald of the Black Vault, he filed a FOIA request asking the DOD to search senior special access program officials' emails for any reference to them. The Pentagon declined, stating the program doesn't exist and that a search therefore would be pointless. A move that a lot of FOIA experts, including John, are saying sidesteps the legal obligation to search for records regardless of official denial. And this decision raises fresh questions about oversight, whistleblower claims, and how alleged black programs are handled when Congress is already involved. And the thing here, folks, isn't the fact that they're not bothering to check or they're denying it exists, you know, all separate conversations. The fact is it's a legal obligation and they're just deciding not to do it. And this is what frustrates me when folks raise FOIA or use examples of FOIA as a win or a proof of something being there or not there. When these things are so underhand and so behind the scenes and so above oversight, past classification almost at times, does FOIA or legalities even matter? And I think stuff like this just really goes to show that. And here's another example of it. Again, we'll stick with reporting from the Black Vault. This is a really interesting news item for me. Another FOIA release gives us a rare look at how the Pentagon controls media access around UAP briefings. Documents have showed that a closed-door UAP briefing in 2024 was not open to the wider press at all. Instead, they sent out invitations quietly to a very small, hand-picked group of outlets, including The New York Times, CNN, Politico, The Washington Post, and Task and Purpose. I've not heard of that last one. Only one person per outlet was allowed. The session was marked off the record for planning purposes, and even remote access wasn't permitted. Other invitees on the response were redacted entirely, meaning we still don't know who else could have been in the room. Taken together, this just paints a picture of how tightly managed the UEP messaging remains, not just for the public, but even for the media covering it, and who gets to cover it, who's allowed to cover it. And when you put those two stories side by side, you know, great work from John Greenwald. The Pentagon refusing to even search for records tied to whistleblower claims and quietly limiting access to a closed-door UEP briefing, a pattern starts to emerge. It's not outright secrecy, but it's tightly controlled transparency. And is that transparency at all? It's carefully managed access, carefully chosen language, and very clear lines around who gets to ask questions and who doesn't. I suppose that would be a good place to even bring up the fact that look at David Grush when that journalist, I won't name the guy because it's so poor, received David Grush's medical records within 24 hours of a FOIA request, allegedly, which then go to show he had potential issues in the past with PTSD, understandably, through his previous roles. It just shows you that things can get out there when they want them to. But again, who is in charge of this? Who's releasing this information? Who's deciding that this information can and can't go to who? Yeah, not a good look, is it, at all, for that whole situation. Moving on, folks, sorry, really strange, isn't it, that it's almost just like lying straight to your face and you having to believe it, you know. You'll eat it and you'll like it, as my mum used to say. Nazca Mummies is back in the news. Will Brown over at Incredible History has just dropped a video which he says concludes the Nazca Mummies are manipulated and butchered human beings, not non-humans or aliens. And I'm not concluding anything here, folks. I'm just reporting the situation because it's something that comes up a lot in listener questions. The whole situation has had me on various sides of the fence, as you'll know, at different times, never fully committing either way. The big issue for me has always been there are strong arguments on both sides, and it's been difficult to see the key people here ever get together and talk it out properly. They don't seem to want to ever do that. Recently, I had Pavel on from the Sequo Activo podcast, and he believes we need to hold off on conclusions while studies are ongoing. And many would agree, particularly the studies being carried out by the institutes like the University of ICA. His view is that we need the data before anyone nails their colours to the mast. And a lot of folks, when you read through the online commentary, say the same thing. However, there's equally as many people like Will Brown, like Darcy Weir, who have spoken with experts who claim there are multiple signs these are manipulated human remains. And that's quite grisly to think of. I've said to Will, to Pavel and others when discussing this, one of the major issues for me has always been Jaime Musan's involvement, the Gaia connections from that channel, and others who simply have been involved in too much nonsense over the years. In his latest video, and the link is in the description, folks, Will Brown points to one of the doctors involved in this was also involved in the Roswell slide hoaxes, which showed a two-year-old, you know, indigenous child remains used as a potential alien body. And again, he's back involved in this. And that's just, you know, it's not a great look, is it, when you're tainted with that kind of stuff. So it's disappointing. I'll leave it to you to make up your own mind, as I always do. Definitely check out Will's video. I'll post it below, like I said. I did reach out to Will to come on and comment, but Will's more or less done with this area now. I think he feels there's no more work for him to do. Here's the conclusive proof from his point of view, and he's moving on. And I completely respect that from Will Brown. So we'll see what else comes up from this. I think in the coming months, there are results due to come out from said university, and we'll see what happens maybe from there. Here's one of those things I pointed to from the beginning of the programme, and it's UFO financial news. Yes, you heard that right. A really interesting story published by the Sunday Times in the UK, which in itself is a pretty big deal. That's a serious, pretty reputable newspaper here in the UK, unlike a Daily Mail or worse, a Daily Star, for example, that we hear often publishing UFO stories with various degrees of accuracy or speculation. An article published in the Sunday Times and later summarised by the investment platform Free Trade, including others, raised an unusual but increasingly serious question. Should central banks prepare for the financial shock of a future disclosure confirming non-human intelligence? crazy stuff to see banks now being involved in this. The article reported that a former Bank of England analyst had warned that such an announcement, particularly if made by the US, could have profound consequences for global financial markets. The concern, as outlined, was not whether such a disclosure is imminent, but whether markets and institutions are equipped to deal with an event that could fundamentally disrupt confidence, pricing, and risk perception. The scenario described suggested that markets could react violently, liquidity could be strained, and traditional stress testing models might prove inadequate for what effectively would be a huge narrative shock here, one that challenges deep-held assumptions about humanity's place in the universe. And that's the context of the reporting. What follows now, folks, is a separate statement provided directly to me by Helen McCaw, who previously worked as an analyst at the Bank of England, and I got to meet Helen at the Saul Foundation. McCaw begins by invoking in her statement a concept familiar to anyone who studies risk. She said, "Before the discovery of Australia, people in the old world were convinced that all swans were white. The belief seemed unassailable, fully supported by observation and experience. The first sighting of a black swan did not simply add new information. It exposed how fragile supposedly settled knowledge can be." Now, that quote was taken from Nassim Nicholas's Taleb's The Black Swan. It frames her argument that institutions are often least prepared for events that sit outside accepted cultural and analytical norms. Helen McCaw points to a recent report by Starlight Insights titled Supervisors on Supervision, which examines the role of culture within central banks and financial supervisory bodies. In that report, economist Sir John Kay warns that regulators must not find themselves unable to act when signals emerge because they have not learned to read them. Culture, he argues, is central to institutional trustworthiness and supervisory effectiveness. And according to Helen McCaw, I think many of you listening will agree that the UEP topic increasingly fits that description. Helen argues that after 5 years of US government legislation, 3 congressional hearings, the release of the Age of Disclosure documentary, that continued institutional avoidance of this subject and the risk becomes a form of cognitive dissonance rather than prudent scepticism. For me, layman's terms, effectively, they're not choosing to be sceptical about this topic and go, you know, we're running the risks and it's not worth talking about. They're just ignoring it completely. And that is so dangerous when we seem to be at a point where perhaps this is something that is more on our doorstep than ever before. In her view, central banks have an obligation to assess emerging financial stability risks, even when doing so challenges cultural norms. She argues there are now sufficient UEP-related signals to justify serious contingency assessment, regardless of where someone stands and their understanding of the UEP subject. She highlights the Age of Disclosure, revealing that then US Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin received a UEP briefing from Jay Stratton, a senior member of the US intelligence community. In that context, Mnuchin reportedly recognised the need to consider the economical impacts of the president going to the microphone and telling the world we are not alone. And I know right now, folks, given what's going on, particularly in the US, that seems a million miles away. For Helen McCaw, in her argument, in her statement to me, this is not an argument about certainty, but about preparedness. She's arguing the government and their central bank should move the UEP topic into the Overton window, the range of issues considered acceptable for mainstream policy discussion. If UEP were ultimately confirmed to be non-human in origin, she says the implications would be profound, requiring domestic policy planning and unprecedented international coordination. The potential consequences, in her view, are simply too great to ignore. And she finished with a couple of quotes here. She closed by referencing Radical Uncertainty by Lord Mervyn King and Sir John Kay. Beliefs are embodied in a narrative, and the prevailing narrative can change in an abrupt or discontinuous fashion when a sufficiently large number of people see evidence that leads them to change their view. And she follows on, and crucially for markets, the valuations in financial markets are for the moment. They change quickly and sometimes violently, reflecting certain knowledge for the future. So those observations, Helen's arguing and underlining why institutions tasked with financial stability cannot afford to dismiss low probability, high impact scenarios simply because they fall outside of what they're comfortable dealing with or talking about. Your money, your policies, your insurance, and this is something I've talked about often before on this podcast, myself or with guests. When you look at what happens after disclosure, that day one, day two, it's not just you go back to work and we know that aliens exist. There's a whole society that is going to change for the good, for the bad. Like I say, overnight, you're not going to be given a little box that magics your car to drive, you know, without any requirement for fuel. Things will change. New subscriptions will come into being. Fossil fuels will be replaced by different energy types. They're not going to be free. You know, you will pay for it. We will pay for it. But yeah, there's a whole interesting conversation there. And I think it's testament to how far this UFO topic has come, that I'm sitting here giving you an update at the end of January in 2026, discussing that the banking sector is now looking at this conversation. We've got science, we've got academics, and I'm going to come back to that in listener questions, some of the places we have now touched with this conversation. Is this a one-off? Is it an article that slipped through the net on a slow news day? Or are we in a place where the major facets of society are readying for a conversation that's been avoided now for a long time? Like I say, I'll come back to this on one of the listener questions. I've prepared a little something to answer on that. And a couple of news items before we get to listener questions, folks. China is preparing to launch a powerful new telescope, space telescope even. The Zhoutian, or Chinese Space Station Telescope, will be into low Earth orbit later this year, designed to survey large swaths of the sky with a field view of hundreds of times greater than the Hubble Telescope. Zhoutian will work alongside China's Tiangong Space Station and is expected to operate for a decade or more once in orbit. So again, I don't know how much the Chinese government or space agency will share with the rest of the Western world, especially, that it gathers. But again, the more telescopes up there in space, you know, along with the James Webb, looking out there at the universe, maybe we see some more incredible things. And again, this may not be the most incredible speculative aspect of the topic, but we're looking further and in more detail than ever before. Something's going to give. Maybe it's going to be down that scientific route. And meanwhile, NASA is on track to make history in February, folks. You might be listening to this in a couple of days in February with its Artemis 2 mission, the first crewed lunar flight in more than 50 years. Is that not unbelievable that we've not had a lunar flight for more than 50 years? Now, they are not going to land on the moon, but Artemis 2 will send a 4-person crew and orbit the moon on a 10-day journey around and back. Although it won't land, the mission's a crucial step toward returning humans to the lunar surface later this decade. And isn't this decade flying along very, very quickly? If you're on the free feed, folks, you'll hear some sponsors and adverts at this point. I really would appreciate you playing them as it helps me keep the lights on, pay some bills and all that kind of stuff. If you hate the ads but love the show, you can always sign up to a paid membership, which I'll touch on at the very end as well. But here are a few short ads to help us out, folks. So just to finish off with some listener questions for this news update, folks. First up from Kevin. Kevin says, "Hey Andy, the Virginia case involved a unique non-human. Unlike the traditional categories in modern ufology at least, I'm wondering if there's anything in the local culture that might have influenced the perception of the creature in the way theorised by Jacques Vallée." So this is an interesting one, and I've thought about this. The description of the Virginia being is quite unique and quite different. It's got those kind of ridges on top of its head. It's got the big eyes, the brown oily skin, the awful, awful smell. And yeah, it's not the classic grey. It's not the mantid. It's not the Nordic. It's not, you know, the insectoid. It's definitely in a category almost of its own. The way I've always thought about the Jacques Vallée side of things and, you know, these objects or beings interpreting themselves, that makes sense to me if it was some kind of projection. But when the being's allegedly been captured, taken by people, hospitalised, then for me that's a physical being and that's just how it looks. So are we saying the beings are created for a purpose, or are we saying this is perhaps a type of being that's been lesser exposed to humanity and has been more of a one-off in terms of not visiting, but the crash and the being exposed to us as a people? Perhaps these aren't the type of beings that normally would interact with humanity, whereas others tend to be. Interesting thought. I'd love to know people's thoughts on that. As always, folks, get in touch with the show. Use the website contact form, email, or if you're on YouTube, comment below. The old subscribe, like, and comment would greatly be appreciated, folks. It really does help out. But yeah, that's an interesting one for me. I'd love to know people's thoughts on that, because that Virginia being does have a particularly unique look to it. And perhaps when I've got James Fox back on, that's something I'll mention to him. He's out in Brazil right now for the 30th anniversary of the Virginia case, and he's been posting some content online. James Fox wasn't lying, folks, when he said he was keeping on top of this. And I think we're going to see or hear more from James very much sooner than later. Tobias says that Beatriz Villarreal shared an update on Facebook a few days ago, maybe worth mentioning. And Tobias, certainly I'm going to give you the stage here. Tobias said, including the update here, some encouraging news. Two independent data analysts who were given access to the transient sample have replicated our core results regarding associations between transients and nuclear testing, as well as the deficit of transients in the Earth's shadow. One, Brian Doherty, has documented his analysis in a short note, while the other, who replicated the Nuclear Transient Association, has chosen not to be named at this stage. These replications are preliminary and non-peer-reviewed, but encouraging. We look forward to additional independent replication efforts, including peer-reviewed ones. I'll just say this, what I love about Beatrice's work, and I'm still doing my best to get Beatrice on. She has said she'll come on. She's a busy woman, and I'm sure that will happen in the near future. But she's not just done this work and then left it out there. It's being followed up. She's encouraging people to check it, to double check it, to triple check it. And that's how science should be done, isn't it? You know, prove me wrong. Show me that this isn't correct. And here are people going out, replicating it. And that replication and repeatability has shown the same results. That is incredibly, incredibly positive in terms of this particular case and Beatrice's transient work, folks. If you haven't seen it before or heard about it, I'm sure many of you have, but the idea essentially looking at pre-Sputnik, pre-1950s satellites that were in the sky, not the little mechanical ones that we send up, but objects in the sky called satellites. They are taking pictures, they are expecting in month one, here's the picture of these stars, here's month three, why have some of them moved or gone? They shouldn't have moved. And that's what's really, really interesting with Beatrice's work. So yeah, great shout to mention that. Casey says, hello Andy, I've had this on my mind for some time. I realise E.T. was 14 years prior to the Virginia case. E.T. was portrayed brown and wet looking, then white and dried when it was sick. The Virginia entities are said to be brown, maybe oily, while outdoors and being hunted. But we now have Dr. Italo Venturelli saying that the being was white while in the hospital. I think we can all agree Spielberg has some inside knowledge. What are your thoughts on his E.T., this being a simple reversal of previous descriptions back then? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Well, the Virginia witnesses are the first the general public has heard this description. So yeah, I suppose for me, folks, and I'm sure some of you more well-researched or potentially older listeners or viewers would be shouting down the microphone here of your phone or laptop, however you're listening. But it wasn't a description that was particularly well known or discussed. I know Star Wars, let's be fair, had all kinds of weird looking creatures. And I mean, pre-George Lucas mucking about with it. In the cantina scene, for example, there were some strange looking beings. Star Trek had some going back into the classic TV show as well. So there were strange creatures and beings portrayed across different shows over the decades before this. But I get what you mean. If you're getting the fact that Spielberg, like a lot of folks have said, he's a guy who's at the top of his profession, has been for decades. So if you're going to get contacts, then that's the type of guy who would. Look at Bryce Zabel, who's releasing his new podcast, Sound Light Frequency, which is going to talk about his series Dark Skies, along with Brent Friedman, getting that put into place. And the people who would be in touch around the filming of it, we've heard the same thing with The X-Files. I imagine Spielberg did have folks who at least put their hand on his shoulder and said, you know, Steven, you're on the right track here. Or indeed, maybe they slipped him a note and said, why don't you just change this small detail? Maybe that's a little bit more accurate. I wonder who the folks who are consulting with Spielberg on Disclosure Day are. I'd be shocked if David Grush perhaps wasn't one of those people. That's not from a place of knowledge, pure speculation. But let's see what comes out when those we get more details on Disclosure Day. I imagine in the coming weeks we must be due another massive trailer for it, one that fleshes out the narrative a little bit more on there. Oh, and on that, folks, Severance, I've just finished season one, had never watched it, phenomenal, and I'm looking forward to watching season two. So I'd love to hear from anyone who's watched the Apple TV show Severance. Get in touch. Not UFO related as far as I can see at the moment, but really weird. Great stuff. That's my kind of TV show, folks. And Algo, final listener question here from Algo, folks. And this is the one I prepared my answer already because I loved the question and I was doing a little bit of work on this regardless. Algo says, the disclosure narrative is creeping into ever more aspects of society. Politics, defence, entertainment, and now finance, as we discussed just below with Helen McCaw. He said, do you agree and what's the driving force? So here we go, folks. For me, what's interesting about the recent discussion around banks and financial stability isn't that institutions are suddenly talking about aliens. It's that sectors of society which once wouldn't touch the subject at all are now engaging with it, quietly, cautiously, and under different language depending on where we are. Finance being a good example. Central banks aren't debating belief, they are debating risk. Specifically what happens to markets, confidence, and liquidity. Like I mentioned, if a long-dismissed unknown suddenly becomes official, that conversation would have been unthinkable a decade ago. The same shift is happening elsewhere. So in defence and national security, unidentified objects are no longer waved away. They're treated as unknowns, operating in controlled airspace, a capability and intent problem, no longer a punchline. In aviation, pilots are now encouraged to report anomalies without stigma because whatever these objects are, they represent a potential flight safety issue. In science and academia, the language has softened. Researchers talk about anomalous data, sensor fusion and unknown physics. No one is rushing to conclusions. Not no one, but you know what I mean. But the ridicule is starting to go. Even theology has moved forward. Religious scholars now discuss non-human intelligence as a philosophical and doctrinal question rather than something incompatible with belief. Media has shifted too. Major outlets now cover the topic without the irony, without the mockery, framing it around governance, transparency and public trust. As I discussed this today, Luis Elizondo has a new interview he's doing. It was literally live as I record this, so more on that in the coming days if anything major comes out of it. But yeah. And perhaps most telling of all, lawmakers can now publicly say, we don't know what this is. Something that used to be politically impossible. It was the death knell for a political career. The common thread here isn't belief in extraterrestrials. It's permission. Permission to discuss it. Permission to dip your toe in the water. Permission to ask, you know, what if? And I think that's a huge, huge step forward. Permission to acknowledge uncertainty, permission to plan for low probability, high impact scenarios, permission to admit that some assumptions we've lived with for decades might not be as solid as we thought. And I'm sure that resonates with a lot of you watching or listening to this. You've spoken to colleagues perhaps today at work, you're going to speak to them tomorrow at work, you've had conversations or had that ridicule for months, weeks, years when you've spoken about it. And that's starting to go. You must be seeing there's a little bit of a sea change in the air when it comes to this topic. Society's not concluding anything at all yet. We're not there yet. But across finance, defence, science, religion and politics, it's quietly preparing for a possibility the narrative could be about to change. That in itself is a potentially seismic shift. So what's the driving force? Is it curiosity? Is it the bell curve of society embracing the conversation as social media algorithms pick up on it? Could it be the phenomenon itself beginning to spread its tentacles through the fabric of society, preparing us for a big D disclosure? Who knows? But it's a positive sign for me, and I'd love to know, as always, what you think. And I love that the fact you've listened to me for this long on this news update. Just before I finish up, folks, as it's the end of the month, I've got another batch of books that have been delivered to me. Did you know I wrote a book? Well, here you go. I can personalise and send it on if you're looking for one. Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects has done incredibly well, folks. Thank you so much for buying a copy or sharing it if you've done that. I've managed to get some new packaging that's dropped my postage slightly here in the UK. It's still pretty expensive around the world, folks. You know, tariffs and all that stuff have not helped. Drop me a message if you want one. The Amazon site in the UK currently has an offer till the end of the month. That's around £8 for the book, the hardback. It's only available in hardback right now, but that deal finishes at the end of January. It's nothing I have control over. It's an Amazon offer, but if you want a book direct from Amazon, US, Australia, etc., they're also available as well. Very grateful for you if you've picked up a copy. If you haven't already, or if you have already and you get a book, please leave a 5-star review, especially on Amazon. It makes a huge difference. And leave a comment along with your review. Even just a couple of words is huge. So if you want a copy of the book signed by me, I'll throw a few stickers in there or something if you want. In the UK, it's £22. In the US, it's $47. In Australia, it's $70. Shipping's wild. And in Europe, it's €34. So a massive thank you. Drop me a message if you want one of those books, folks, and I'll get some shipped out. I don't know how long I can do this for while it's financially viable at those prices. And also a massive thank you to everyone who joined up with a paid membership in the month of January. I was truly taken aback, and I'm incredibly grateful, whether it was a YouTube membership, a Patreon membership, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. Remember, Patreon and Apple have free trials too. It all helps me get towards that goal of doing this full time and leaving that normal 9-to-5 job behind. You get early access to episodes, no adverts or sponsors, and bonus content too. With that, folks, thank you for listening. Send over any of those questions for myself and for guests upcoming on the show. Patrick Jackson was meant to be on discussing the Sphere Network. Patrick had a bit of a cough, so he's delayed it for a few days. So I can still take questions for Patrick. Excuse me. Remember, I've also got coming up on the show in the coming weeks, Richard Dolan will be on with me with a special subject matter we'll be discussing. I'll announce that nearer the time. Joe McMonagall is over his health issues, and he'll be on the podcast middle of February. We're booked in for that one, folks. I've still got lots of questions from you, but send in more. Danny Sheehan will be coming on with me to cover the recent announcements and what was said by Kurt McConnell, Eric Burleson and co at the Virginia press conference. Darcy Weir will be discussing his latest documentaries. Bryce Zabel will join me to discuss his brand new podcast. Gary Heseltine will be discussing his work from a UK perspective on the Rendlesham Forest case and more. All that in the coming month, plus lots more, folks. The posts are there with all those guests and who they are and what they're about, on the Facebook page, on the Patreon page, on a free page, so you can check that out, and on the YouTube page too. So get your questions over. It makes the shows even better. Your questions are wonderful, your input's wonderful, and I love hearing from you. Even if you're just dropping me over an email to tell me about Severance or a show you've watched, I love hearing from you. Thank you so much, everyone, and I will speak to you all very, very soon. That's all for this episode of That UFO Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. If you enjoyed the show, please follow, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps others find the show. If you're watching on YouTube, hit like, subscribe, and turn on notifications so you don't miss future episodes. You can also support the show directly and get early access, ad-free episodes, and bonus content on Patreon, or by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube memberships. All the links are over at thatufopodcast.com or in the show description below, along with merchandise and more. Don't forget, you can also pick up a copy of my book, Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects, available now in all good bookstores and through online retailers, including Amazon. Big thank you again to all of you for listening and tuning in. Until next time, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and